Welcome to the political cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
All right, everybody, welcome to the political cesspool radio program, Saturday evening, March 19th. It has been an exhausting 2 days for me, but I am through it, and it is good to be here with you tonight, breathing a sigh of relief. We are going to have a very fun show for you this evening. We've got a couple of great guests. I'll tell you more about them a little bit later this hour. But first, of course, joining me this Saturday night here from our friendly confines at AM 1380 WLRM Studios in downtown Memphis, Tennessee, our flagship, is Keith Alexander. Keith, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm suffering from spring fever, though, this beautiful spring weather we're having here in Memphis right now. I may fall asleep sometime through the show. You'll have to nudge me, wake me up from time to time, I think.
Well, I don't know about that, because I got to let everyone in on a little political cesspool behind-the-scenes secret. You know, it is March Madness, spring fever. Anyone watching the NCAA tournament, you can imagine that before these so-called student-athletes take the floor, you can imagine them in the locker rooms, getting pumped up, listening to, a song written by some pervert that can't carry a tune about killing his mother or killing some cops or whatever these, kids are listening to nowadays. But that's how we do it here in the political cesspool. And Keith and I also like to get pumped up before a show. And we were doing that tonight, listening to one of the greatest hits, not just of 1957, but of all time. Keith, tell them what it was.
Paul Anka and Diana. It's James's doo-wop. James was definitely born in the wrong decade. He is a 1950s greaser misplaced in the 2010s.
Well, be that as it may, I'll tell you this. I know good music when I hear it, regardless of what era it comes from, and it just doesn't get much better, other than Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, mind you. Man, Diana by Paul Anka. I've been attracted to that song for so many reasons. First of all, it tickles my Western funny bone, such a classic name, Diana, the Roman goddess of the moon, I believe she was. And then that song, in and of itself, see, that song had real heart. That was a real song. See, back then, the artists actually wrote the songs that they sing. They didn't have, like I said, some pervert writing it for it. And that song was actually, Paul Anka wrote that song, reminiscing about when he was 13 and in love with his 18-year-old babysitter, and it never worked out for him, but he made millions of dollars off the song, Keith, so I guess that was worth it.
Yeah, I tell you what, they just don't make them like that anymore, and James is a true connoisseur of 50s doo-wop. If anyone doubts it, you know, James's devotion to doo-wop, I think he sees just about everything except Home and Family.
Well, you know, I'm tempted to dedicate the whole hour just to telling you some of my greatest songs. But I guess that's another show, or perhaps not this show at all. Maybe I'd have to host a second program. James's doo-wop classics or something. But this is the political cesspool. You haven't tuned into the wrong program. We're just telling you what we do to get focused for a show. And anyway, enough about that. I guess we ought to move on to more pressing affairs, Keith. Got a lot to talk about tonight, as I mentioned. The blog, I thought we've had some particularly good blog entries posted this week at thepoliticalcesspool.org, and I know a couple of them even motivated Keith to add them to his roster of content for this, our first hour. So, Keith, what do you have on the agenda first with what little time left we have in this segment?
Well, let's talk about the Frank Sinatra one, The House I Live In, which was a propaganda short movie made by Hollywood pushing the multicultural agenda even back in 1946, James.
Yeah, listen, we're really keeping it in the 40s and 50s this first segment. We're going from music to politics now, but we're keeping it in the era. But if you didn't catch that blog entry, I thought it was certainly a good one, if I do say so myself, and it hit on a couple of points that have really been circulating this week. It resonated with the readers, and it has been reposted to Alternative Right and the Occidental Observer, and Keith, you might want to know that YouTube has now, as a result of us posting it to the Cesspool site, has taken down that video.
Yep, they don't want it being used for unauthorized purposes, do they, James? They, you know, you've got to show the proper respect. And, you know, the thing that's so amazing is that it shows that Jewish power and influence was busily at work, particularly in Hollywood, even back then. You know, I had heard that Jews and Jewish power and influence got interested in the movie industry when Birth of a Nation came out. I think that was, what, about 1916 or something, and they said, boy, this sure is a powerful medium to, you know, influence public opinion, because as a result of Birth of a Nation, that led to the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. So from that point on, the Jewish community seemed to be working overtime to get their camel's nose in the tent of the movie industry. You had Carl Laemmle that had Universal Studios. They're the ones that did all the horror movies back in the 20s and 30s. Then you had Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Sam Goldwyn and Louis B. Mayer. Then you had the Warner Brothers, Jack Warner, Jewish also. And by the 40s, they basically had accomplished a coup d'etat, and you have them working to basically undermine the old traditional American stock and promote what we now call multiculturalism or minority rights, James.
Well, that's exactly what it did, and as I said, for the past week, up until this morning, we had the video posted in the blog entry titled The House That I Live In. That was, of course, the song and movie of the same name. It was a short film, 10 minutes long, starring Frank Sinatra. It won a couple of Academy Awards, as you might imagine, because of the propaganda that it pushed. And Keith's exactly right. Based upon the successful propaganda used in Birth of a Nation, the left saw what a tool that could be and have certainly more than commandeered it for their own uses in the years since. And, of course, now it's absolutely totally dominated by their own submission. But 1946, The House That I Live In was one of their first really big scores in making their very alien ideas seem to be mainstream. And Keith, I know we're coming up on a break. Perhaps you can give them a quick synopsis of what goes on in this film if they've not yet read my blog entry, and we can follow up on it after the first segment.
Well, it's like the anti-bullying campaign now. You have a bunch of Catholic ethnic second wave of immigration guys from up north, usually probably Irish or Italian, and they're about to beat up a Jewish kid. And what happens is Frank Sinatra happens on the scene and tells them only Nazis would do something like that, and that we need to be reconciled to the fact that we're going to be living together with all sorts of ethnic minorities. In fact, the guy that wrote the song, who was Jewish, I think his name was Mirpol, was a real far-out leftist. And he was very upset with the movie because they did not include blacks in it. They thought that might be a bridge too far back in 1946. But by 1956, it was mainstream.
Well, Keith, and it wasn't just that. It wasn't just that they were going to beat him up. We have no problem with that being the message. You know, anti-violence was that people who believed that religion was important were Nazis. That was even more of the underlying theme than not just quote-unquote bullying.
We'll
continue on with this train of thought right after this. Stay tuned, everybody.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, during that first segment, after we got done talking about Paul Anka's greatest hits, we moved into one of the left-wing's greatest hits, one of their first number ones, if you will, The House That I Live In, movie, song of the same name, 1945-46, it came out. Starred Frank Sinatra. The plot, as Keith mentioned, was simple. Sinatra plays himself, heads outside for a cigarette break in the middle of a recording session. He happens upon a bunch of kids getting ready to pummel another. Turns out that the kid that was going to be on the short side of the stick in this hypothetical mob was a young Jewish boy. And again, as we stressed in the last segment, the purpose of the film wasn't that it's bad to go around and beat up other people who aren't exactly like you. We have no problem with that message, no problem with any message that curtails violence. That wasn't the message of the film at all. What they stressed in the film was that religion itself was not important, and anyone who thinks that religion is important, or race for that matter, is a Nazi or someone that's stupid, and that's something that's repeated time and time again in the movie. You have to go and watch it for yourself on YouTube to really get the full effect, or read my article on the matter, which, as I said, has been circulated. This was, from top to bottom, a communist production, and that is very evident from the references and links that I have added into the article that is featured tonight at thepoliticalcesspool.org. See, back then, ideas like that were only heard from by radicals, by communists, 1945, 1946, for people to believe that religion was just a triviality, that race was meaningless. You know, you'd have to be a radical communist, which, and of course, we know what most communists were, to believe that. But now, unfortunately, after 60, 70 years of brainwashing by the media, this is a seemingly mainstream view parroted in even our churches these days. And Keith, so that was pretty much the thesis of my article there. It's a pretty good one. Like I said, if I say so myself, the house that I live in, check it out before it gets pushed down the blog world too far at thepoliticalcesspool.org. And Keith, I know that's one that you particularly enjoyed.
What I enjoyed about it, James, was just how subtly it was done. It's incredible the type of things that Hollywood can sugarcoat for people and get them to go along with, where if you just came out and forthrightly stated a position like that, that religion isn't important and Christianity, is nothing to get upset about, and any attack on Christianity is not anything to get upset about, people would react, you know, as you would expect them to and as it would be appropriate to. But they managed to, you know, what's the old expression in advertising, sell the sizzle rather than the steak. And they are always, you know, I think it was Aldous Huxley that said, anything too stupid to be said may always be sung. And that's, Hollywood has proven that time and again. And, you know, it's amazing that they saw early on the potential that the movie medium and radio and later on television had in molding public opinion. It's psychological conditioning, pure and simple, and this was a perfect example of it, even back in the mid-40s.
Well, Keith, like I said, there's not much more we can say, but we do encourage people to read it for themselves at our website. Where do you want to go from here?
Well, there's a great article that came out that fits right in with the topic that we've been covering really off and on for the past several months. It's an article in the Commercial Appeal 2 days ago called Shrinking City. Memphis has lost more than 3,000 residents since the 2000 census. The first, there have only been two decennial or every 10-year censuses since the yellow fever epidemic in Memphis in the 1870s, when Memphis has actually lost population. And they managed to lose population over the last 10 years, despite the fact that they had annexed a section of the county, Shelby County, in which Memphis is located, called Cordova, that had over 35,000 people in it. So they've lost well over 35,000 people from Memphis proper. And, of course, they mentioned every reason imaginable except the obvious one, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the living room, Jane.
I wonder what it could be. Why would people not want to live, even guilty white liberals, why are they fleeing Memphis proper, Keith?
Well, Memphis is the only major city in the state of Tennessee with a black majority population. It says in this article, for example, that Memphis has Shelby County has gone from 48.5 to 52.1%, and Memphis now has 63.3% 3% black residents. And if there's one thing that will certainly kill a city, it's a black majority, which then in turn elects black politicians to rule. And of course, James, I don't have to tell you, but let's tell the people out here in the audience, it is a weekly, and I'm not exaggerating, occurrence in Memphis that some black appointed or elected official, generally making six figures or more a year, is caught cheating, conniving, got his hand in the till, outright stealing, sexual abuse, whatever it is. Any of those things is what's going to happen. And we just had the head of the impound lot in Memphis, who was caught stealing laptop computers and other stuff out of the interior of cars that were impounded and driven to the lot. So, you know, there's another one bites the dust. But, of course, it's so commonplace that basically we're conditioned to ignore it. But this is what kills the city. This is how your city is on the way to Detroit. Memphis is following Detroit. You know, the first major American city that had a black mayor was Camden, New Jersey in 1969. And I remember in his election party, which was covered by all three of the alphabet soup networks back then, ABC, CBS, and NBC, he said, "I don't know where America's going, but Camden's going to get there first." And of course, that was prophetic in an ominous way, because Camden, New Jersey just closed down its last library branch, and it is indistinguishable in many respects from Detroit, Michigan. And of course, Detroit is kind of like a little bit of Haiti or sub-Saharan Africa here in America.
Well, Keith, you know, if you're going to do a big article examining why Memphis is the only major city in Tennessee that has a declining population, you're looking at all the variables. You are just being absolutely dishonest. You are being a terrible journalist. You're being derelict in your journalistic duties not to at least mention the fact that perhaps racial demographics have something to do with this problem. If you're looking at what Memphis has that these other cities don't have, and why Memphis is the only one of these cities that are declining, and this is the only variable in play, you know, to me, it seems as though there might be something there worth exploring. But then again, that violates the dictates of political correctness. And if you can't, you know, defy the false gods of cultural Marxism in the press, it's got to be something that's not so obvious that they've got to uncover. There's got to be some very complex answer out there that some smart journalist is going to discover.
Well,
it can't
James,
be the obvious.
James, it's like the emperor's new clothes. Everybody sees it, but nobody wants to comment about it.
That's exactly right. But we'll talk about it. And like I said, we can tell the truth in love. We're certainly not here to offend anyone. But the fact of the matter remains that, you know, white flight's real. And it happens, and it has consequences. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool Guys will be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
All right, welcome back to the show. We're having all sorts of technical difficulties here at WLRM this evening. And when we have these technical difficulties, our brains tend to go a little bit haphazard. But we're trying to keep it in the ditches here. For you as we, between the ditches as we navigate through some glitches this evening, and I'm going to turn it back over to Keith on that note.
Yeah, what we're talking about was the Shrinking City article in Commercial Appeal, noting that Memphis, which is the largest city in Tennessee, is shrinking for the first time, really only the second time since 1870 in size. And Nashville is growing. Everything else in all the other major cities in Tennessee are growing. Well, Nashville has a 24% black population. Memphis has a 63.5% black population. Chattanooga has a 23% black population. Knoxville has a 17% black population. So there's your answer. It's an answer that political correctness decrees dare not be uttered, but it's obvious and it's the truth. And, you know, the truth has no agenda as far as we're concerned. Tell the truth will set you free, like the Bible says. This is following exactly what, you know, is predictable, has happened before. Haiti, for example, was once called the Jewel of the Caribbean back in, I think, around the turn of the 18th to the 19th century. And then they had, you know, the dream of every black revolutionary. They had a revolution where all the white people were either killed or driven off the island, and or at least out of the part that's Haiti. And since then, Haiti has been synonymous with ignorance, disease, superstition, voodoo, everything negative, and poverty, everything that you can think of. And this is, you know, we're seeing the same pattern followed in Detroit, Camden, New Jersey. Memphis is not as far down the road, but we're heading down that road. And quite frankly, all the United States will be heading down that road, because in the year 2042, the UN demographers have predicted that America will no longer be, at that year, at that point in time, a majority white country. You know, there's a YouTube video about Hiroshima and Detroit, comparing both of them, both in 1945 and today. And from the look of things, you'd think that the Japanese had won the war. In 1945, Detroit was a growing, dynamic city with impressive architecture and a vibrant economy, the showplace of American industrial economic might and efficiency, while Hiroshima was a bombed-out ruin. Now the roles are reversed. Hiroshima is pristine, prosperous, and orderly, while Detroit looks like a bombed-out, decaying ruin. The difference is that in Detroit, in 1945, was run and governed by whites, while today it's run and governed by blacks and has been basically since the early 70s when Coleman Young became the first black mayor of Detroit. Now, you can't maintain Western civilizational standards under black rule and with a black predominant population. Hiroshima, of course, has no blacks, or hardly any. Blacks are parasites who depend upon a large host population of whites in order to be in a first-world environment. When the whites depart, so does order, upkeep, and civilization, so it's not long until advanced decay sets in. Looks kind of like Haiti, except that the Haitians were never industrious or resourceful enough to build the type of great, once great building that you see decaying and abandoned in Detroit today, which just proves that up until about 40 years ago, whites still predominated in Detroit, while they haven't predominated in Haiti for over 200 years. Haiti is a harbinger of what the future holds for Detroit and the rest of America. And we've already told you about the mayor of Camden, New Jersey, said, "I don't know where America's going, but Camden's going to get there first." He's prophetic. Camden now looks much like Detroit. As whites become a minority in America, more and more of America will look like Detroit and Camden, and blacks will react by drawing deeper and deeper into denial. They just can't come to terms with the fact that there is not one prosperous first-world black country in the world. You have Nigeria, for example, which is sitting on a gold mine of oil and petroleum resources, but it's still a third-world hellhole. Likewise, Zimbabwe was the former Rhodesia, which under white rule was called the breadbasket of Africa. Now it's the basket case of Africa. It exists solely, like Haiti, on the basis of foreign aid from white nations. Now, the lesson is there for anyone to see. If you don't believe your lying eyes, just hide and watch. It's going to continue to happen. And Memphis has, you know, put the final nail in the coffin with the Memphis City school system, in effect, merging itself in a hostile takeover type scenario with the predominantly white County school system, which is one of the top five school systems in Tennessee, while Memphis is one of the bottom two. Memphis has all Fs. There's only one other system in Tennessee that has all Fs, according to the state report card, and Shelby County has all A's, and there are only four other school systems in the state of Tennessee that have all A's. Now, when working class and lower middle class white people can't find a good public translation-free school system, they start moving away. They start filtering out, and that's what's happening in Memphis. And this is something that is going to continue on in America. It's going to come to your community because of this parasite-host relationship. As more and more of America starts to look like Detroit, Camden, and Haiti, we're going to find minorities fleeing to places that haven't been known for their minorities before, places like Dubuque, Iowa, Provo, Utah, Salt Lake City. It's as inevitable as the sun rising in the east and setting in the west. Now, let's get on to the next one on our topic. James is busy here trying to be a computer technician, which is, quite frankly, I wish we had the cameras rolling here. It would really be good. He's down on it. He looks like he's shooting craps. He's on his knees, bent over. It looks like he's praying here.
Yeah, I'm praying that we could use the microphone. But I tell you what, I'm praying for miracle and thankful for my blessings. Yeah, I'm thankful that I've got a great co-host that can carry the show while I'm
Well, let's give it a shot here. Let's get into the next topic, nuclear energy in America. And we're talking now about the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear generator breeder reactor plant meltdown in Japan and the future of alternative energy in America. You know, I guess we can be glad we're not on the cutting edge of things. We're not like Camden, New Jersey in America for the most part. And likewise, we're not like Japan and European nations that have all sorts of nuclear power plants. We have a few in America. Of course, the left-wing environmental movement wants us to have more and to do away with all fossil fuels. Everything associated with fossil fuels is bad. Now, in Memphis, we get all of our electricity generated by coal-fired steam turbine system out at what's called the Thomas H. Allen Steam Plant. Now, the Obama administration thinks this is a terrible thing, and they want us to pay some type of incredible surcharge called a cap-and-trade tax in order to continue to use it, and hopefully we'll be bludgeoned into switching over to nuclear power or windmill power or something else, some other type of solar power or whatever. We have things that don't work, and then we have something dangerous like nuclear power. Now, everybody is worried to death about suitcase nuclear bombs and other weapons getting into the country. But let me tell you, the cheapest way to have a nuclear explosion would be for some terrorist to detonate some type of bomb within a nuclear breeder reactor facility. They would have a consequent nuclear bomb go off, just like it's about to happen in Japan right now. And thank goodness we don't have that type of problem. You know, in Europe, in Russia with Chernobyl, people are dying from crops that were grown within 100 miles of Chernobyl. It's basically, for 1,000 years, you can't do any of the farming and whatnot.
On that lovely thought, ladies and gentlemen, we got to take a break. We will be right back as the political festival rolls on.
Guys, we'll be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
We'll be right back.
jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang, call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, everybody, welcome back as we continue to navigate through some uncharted waters here at KULRN Radio tonight. We get it all worked out, though. We're still having a great show. I tuned into the internet simulcast there during the break, and still seems as though we're going out loud and clear to all of our affiliates. So the problems that we are faced with here tonight in studio is not noticeable to our audience, and we are excited and thankful for that. Having a great show tonight so far. Thanks to Keith Alexander, while I am being makeshift engineer here at WLRM. It's a skeleton crew on the weekend. You would think with stars like us, Keith, they'd keep a full staff here. We got a couple of interns. They just don't know how to handle things on the Memphis end.
I think they're telling us what type of stars we really are, James.
Yeah. I don't know, though. Our heads barely fit in the room.
Speak for yourself, James.
Nevertheless, we are having a good show. And as is typical with all of our broadcasts, we are covering the hot topics. And we try to tell the truth in love. But I'll tell you, serious matters, serious issues call for serious debate. And that's what we give you every night. We talk live on the air, uncensored and unrehearsed, the way people speak in the privacy of their own homes, where they feel comfortable enough to be candid. We just feel comfortable enough and confident enough in our positions that we can be frank about these taboos in public, hit you right between the eyes with some stone-cold truth, and that's what you get every Saturday night here on our award-winning radio program. We've covered some good issues so far. We got a great 2 hours forthcoming. Some great guests. We'll get to, did you know that the inventor of scruples is going to be on the show tonight, Keith? The guy who invented
it? I read your little thing. Yes, I did look at the blog today and saw that. Plus, you're going to have Nicholas Stix here, who is one of the great minds of paleoconservatism, in my opinion, at least.
Well, we're going to be talking to Nicholas Stix about the UCLA scandal involving that buxom blonde. So that's reason enough alone to say. just hearing us talk about that is reason enough for you to stay till the third hour. And, of course, Dr. Henry Mankow of SaveTheMails.com or .ca, it's a Canadian website, will be on. He invented scruples. So, I don't know, is scruples old enough to be, is that board game old enough to put in the same league with my musical taste, Keith? Or?
No, it's more recent. Everything is more recent than your musical taste. Let's run back now and try to touch again on the nuclear disaster in Japan and what the consequences are for the United States. We were talking before the last break about how vulnerable nuclear power plants would make the United States if we had a proliferation of them, if we had totally sold out to the gurus of alternative energy power like Europe and like Japan have done. Thank goodness we haven't, because the cheapest nuclear bomb that could ever be made is for some terrorist to detonate some type of standard explosive in a nuclear breeder reactor like the one that they have at Daiichi, at Fukushima Daiichi in Japan. Now, there's an old song from the turn of the 19th to the 20th century called "I Want a Girl Just Like the Girl That Married Dear Old Dad." Well, I want to do a variation on that theme. I want an energy system just like the energy system that dear old dad had, and which has proven very reliable and very good and serviceable to the United States. You know, we have endless supplies of coal in the United States. We have coal-generated electrical power plants all over the country, and quite frankly, in Memphis, I have a white car. I don't come out and see coal dust on it ever. We have nice, fresh air for a city. The only thing that pollutes our city in Memphis are these 20-year-old cars with tailpipes dragging, driven in the minority sections of town. It certainly has nothing to do with the power plant. We have good water, and all of this stuff about fossil fuels being so bad is just a bunch of hogwash. It is an excuse to tax us for the very air we breathe. And this is another perfect example of why in America, we don't want to trade down. We don't want to bring in dangerous nuclear plants that are, you know, can have consequences that can basically ruin our ability to be self-sustaining for as long as 1,000 years if you have something go wrong, and replace a perfectly serviceable system that uses coal and we use petroleum products for our cars and for our buses and for everything that's mobile. We shouldn't use any of that to generate heat or electricity, James. And furthermore, we need to be working, you know, to get every drop of oil in the United States drilled and online. And furthermore, we need to pass a law that says that any petroleum that is pumped out of the ground in America or in our territory has to be consumed, has to be used in America. I was absolutely astounded and flabbergasted, James, to find out that all that oil and gas that we're producing in Alaska is never making it down to the lower 48. It's all being sent to the Far East, to the Chi-Coms, to the Koreans, to the Japanese, and to the Taiwanese. Now, we used to have an economy run by economic patriots, people like Henry Ford, who willingly and gladly converted his automobile manufacturing plants into weapons plants, building B-24s and tanks and things like this during World War II. Now we have captains of industry that don't give two hoots about the American people. And they're not going to operate things for the benefit of the American people. We have politicians, though, who are supposedly answerable to us, and we need to insist that they represent our interests rather than the interests of some pie-in-the-sky globalist regime, James.
As soon as Keith, you see, the people here at the studio are trying to make amends. You remember a couple of weeks ago, they brought us pizza. I think this was in celebration of my big interview with CNN. Well, apparently somebody grilled out hamburgers. Family must have had a party or something. And I was just brought a hamburger by one of the WLRM staffers.
You can see James right now. He looks like a woodchuck with Bob Sullivan's pizza.
As much as pontificating as Keith has done this hour, one second he stops, take a breath, is the second I get handed this burger from the WLRM staffer.
Yeah, well, James.
Thank you, Keith.
Yeah, James looked like a like some type of ravenous animal. He just swallowed that hamburger at one fell swoop, and it had both of his cheeks bulging out like some puffer fish or something here.
Hey, I get down to business. I'm serious about my politics and my food.
He's a man of large natural appetite.
That's right. I don't know where it all goes. I must have the metabolism of a shrew, as you say. I sure don't put on weight.
But I tell you what, well, that'll happen later on. Let me tell you now. Now that you have children, that will definitely happen. Now, the other thing that we need to be make sure that the public does not miss in this Japanese nuclear disaster is that we have all the resources we need to be self-sufficient in standard traditional sources of energy. And until they work the kinks out with these new alternative sources of energy, like nuclear energy, then we don't need to step into the void or into the black hole and commit irreparable harm to our nation. We need to tell the liberals that just like everything else that liberals have proposed, your energy policy will not work. We're going to continue to use coal and petroleum and other fossil fuels until you work out the kinks, and we need to have people in Congress that aren't going to be able to be bought off by people like T. Boone Pickens and his wind farm flatboodle, people that will actually represent the best interests of America from a conservative standpoint. Liberalism is a failed theory. Everything it touches, it turns to crap, James, and we need to insist that liberalism not ruin our nation with radioactive waste. as it looks like it's going to happen to large segments of Japan. Are you there?
I guess that was my cue. I'm still trying to figure out these secondary mics. I can tell people, we got to get cameras in the studio. You got to see what's going on here tonight. I can't even figure out how to work this new microphone. Maybe between the first and second hour break, we'll get it all back up 5x5. But nevertheless, I do want to thank Keith Alexander here for carrying this hour to the extent that he did. I had so many good notes prepared. We were just going to have such a good rapport and exchange with one another. It didn't quite work out that way, but thankfully there's still 2 hours left. But I don't get to any of it tonight because we do have a couple of great guests, as we mentioned. I guess my work for next week's show is half done already. And Keith, anything you want to say in closing as this first hour? I think the time flies by on the show each and every week. It really flies by when you're having problems.
This is our example, the Fukushima Daiichi meltdown, I guess. But it's, we got it.
We'll be back in the second hour, folks. Stay tuned. We hope.
Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting hallelujah. Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit and looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the amen.